This podcast is produced by the Center for Deployment Psychology at the Uniformed Services University of the Health Sciences. The views expressed are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of the Uniformed Services University, the Department of Defense, or the U.S. government. In addition, references to any specific companies, products, processes, or services does not necessarily constitute or imply endorsement by the Uniformed Services University, the Department of Defense, or the U.S. government.
Hey, listeners, we're trying something new this year. Come join us live on Tuesday, August 13th from 10 a.m. to noon Eastern. We will take questions and stories from you, our listeners.
Maybe you have a question for one of our previous guests or even about the episode you're listening to today. Do you have a question for us or a great what is your why story? Either way, we want to hear it.
So call in and we'll address your questions and we'll include them in our final episode of the season. And if you can't call on August 13th, automated operators are standing by right now. Send us a voicemail on our SpeakPipe or an email, and all of our contact info will be below.
Can't wait to hear from you.
Welcome to CDP's podcast, Practical for Your Practice,
where we give you actionable intel to support what you do, one colleague to another. Hello, everybody, and welcome to CDP's Practical for Your Practice podcast. I'm Corinne Lefkowitz, and I am joined by my friend and colleague, Dr. Jenna Ermold. Hi, Jenna.
I'm feeling so good that you said friend before colleague. That just sort of made my day, Corinne. So happy to be here as always. Excited to be moving forward.
And that's why I call you friend. See? Because you're so lovely to have here. I'm excited to have you here too. I'm excited about this episode because I think, at least for me, it's going to be a big learning experience since I am not very familiar with the topic of medication-assisted treatment. How about you, Jenna? Is this something you know a lot about?
I am right there with you.
Okay.
So we are very excited.
Yeah, we're going to be well educated and we're going to come out the other side much more proficient because we are lucky enough to be joined today by Catherine Perry, who is a clinical director at the Ripple Ranch. And she is going to tell us all about medication assisted treatment and especially how to use it in conjunction with evidence based psychotherapy. So, welcome, Catherine. We're so happy to have you here.
Hi, thank you so much. I'm happy to be here.
Excellent. Well, I was hoping we could get started by just hearing a little bit about you and having you introduce yourself to our listeners and tell us what you do.
Absolutely. So I am a clinical director here at Ripple Ranch Recovery. We are a inpatient facility. I'm actually a licensed master of social work, almost done with my hours to become a licensed clinical social worker. Woo-hoo! So hopefully by the end of March, I'll be fully done. Whoop, whoop.
Yeah.
I'm very excited about that. I'm also a licensed chemical dependency counselor. I've been in the counseling field for about 5 years now and working with clients who struggle with substance use. I'm a mom of a 8-month-old and have been married for about 8 years as well and live in San Antonio, Texas.
So busy that's a little lady.
Very, very. Man, life is very busy these days.
You had me at 8-month-old. That's a fun but busy time. Well, we are really grateful then. Thank you for taking the time to come chat with us today, given everything that you have going on.
Absolutely.
And we thought we would kind of start a little more general with sort of what your overall philosophy or approach is in working with comorbid substance use and mental health diagnoses. We know that there's some good suggestions from the literature that if we treat them independently, like we go after the substance use disorder, or we go after, let's say, the PTSD, that's not as effective. But So can you share a little more about that? Would be amazing.
Absolutely. I am a big proponent for we have to treat both. Majority of the time, the substance use is a byproduct of a mental health issue is what we find. And a lot of times that mental health issue is also a trauma issue. We are a very, very trauma-informed area where I work. And so we come from a place of understanding trauma is probably the source of a lot of the issues, including it exacerbating any mental health issues that may present for a client. Whenever they present with the substance use disorder, if we're not treating and managing the substance use to be stabilized, then we're not able to really dive into that mental health or trauma issue that needs to be addressed in order to help them not continue to use substances. So the marriage of attacking both is really important. And sometimes it's a really big bear. Like it's huge. It's a big ball of mess. It's hard to pick apart and get the strings all in line because it's just intertwined. So depending on where that client is in certain settings is how far we're going to get with addressing one or the other or both. But our goal is to address both because it's addressing the whole person.
I imagine explaining that big bear to folks, you know, I might think it would be helpful to maybe talk about how do you present that to clients that, you know, sort of we as clinicians understand, you know, how one kind of impacts the other, but how do you, because I think to have success, like understanding the rationale for concurrent treatment is really important. Like, how do you present that to clients?
Absolutely. I think that whenever I have a client in front of me, I try to, hearing their story, I will listen to kind of the key things that tell me, oh yeah, this substance was to self-medicate this issue. And so I will very much normalize that, of course, you are using this thing because it's unbearable what you were going through. And so it sounds to me that you were using substances as a vehicle of how to fix it, quote unquote, for this mental health issue that's going on or this trauma that you had and not having to deal with it because that pain was too much to handle without having something to fix it. And so they found this vehicle that helped them navigate that in a more manageable way. And so helping them normalize versus how society can kind of make it a moral issue, I think really helps let their guard down and be like, yeah, I was just hurting and I found a way to make it hurt less. So if I can help them understand that and take some of that guilt and shame out of the picture, it really does help them kind of navigate this in a different way.
Catherine, I kind of chuckled at something you said earlier when you said that working with clients with comorbid substance use and mental health issues is sometimes a big lift or sometimes a bear. And I chuckled because I thought, my gosh, it's always a complicated situation. And that really resonates from the way that you're talking about it now, just even talking about all of the different levels, how you understand it as a clinician, how you explain it to patients, how you provide a rationale, how you address the stigma that comes along with all of that. So I personally really appreciate you describing it that way. And I'm happy to reveal that I personally find what you do intimidating. Like I find it, that's why I'm so happy to have you here to educate us, because it sounds like it could be overwhelming at times. So I guess maybe the next step is even just to define a little bit for people like me who don't know a whole lot, what medication-assisted treatment is. So what is it for those of us who are new to this?
Sure. So medicated-assisted treatment has a lot of polarizing views on it. So medicated-assisted treatment, at its definition, is there's a medication that is assisting this client with their substance of choice. Typically, it is going to be for an opiate. So someone who uses fentanyl, heroin, or Oxycontin, any kind of painkiller medication that is an opiate, the withdrawals from those types of substances are very, very significant, and they're very hard to manage. And the rate of going back to using and relapsing is really high. So this medication that they are getting is helping them address the cravings and the withdrawal symptoms that can be very unbearable. So when they're using this medication, it's helping them stay stable and it's lessening the negative effects of the withdrawal of that drug. Now, opiates are not the only one. Alcohol is another one that has medicated assisted treatment. Naltrexone or Vivitrol are the common ones for that, or Anabuse. A lot of people have heard about Anabuse. It's the one, if they drink, they get sick. I think that's kind of more of an outdated medicated assisted treatment for alcohol. And now we have better ones. And they're a little more easier to prescribe because a primary care physician can do that. Whereas the opiate ones are a little harder to prescribe because it is a controlled substance typically that is treating that. But what it does is it helps those receptors on the brain be able to not have intensified cravings and also not go through that huge withdrawal period that can be one really dangerous depending on the substance and can be really traumatizing for some people in some ways, to where they have a really hard time getting better and staying sober.
That's really helpful. And I think one of the things that Corinne and I are well versed in leveraging good evidence-based psychotherapies for different types of presenting problems. Like both of us train on treating PTSD. Corinne is a CPT trainer. I'm a prolonged exposure therapy trainer. We understand good evidence-based treatments for depression and anxiety. How does it look when you're kind of combining or using medication-assisted treatment with an EBP? What does that look like? Is there a way to kind of describe that and give us more information of what your experience is in that realm?
Absolutely. So I am an EMDR therapist, so I do utilize trauma therapy as well. So I love having other trauma
Look at
therapists
that. We're representing across the range of
Yeah, this might
that.
be the first time that we've had like three different modules represented here. This is exciting.
That's
Not
so
cool.
the I was going to say the three horsemen of the PTSD apocalypse, but it would be four really. So.
Love it. Well, I think. And I know for most evidence-based practice, if somebody's not lucid enough, it's not going to work. So stabilization is a really big piece of this. And I think mat treatment can really help someone with that. Now, there may be a period where they're having to get stable with the mat treatment. Sometimes it's a little bit of a song and dance to get the right dosage for certain things, especially when it comes to opiate use disorder. So the number one mat medication for opiates is buprenorphine or Suboxone. A lot of people know that's kind of a common one as well. They're kind of one and the same. They just have a few variations to it. That takes a little bit of stabilization process. And so we want to let them kind of get stable. But if they are
Sure.
not on medication-assisted treatment and they're going through chronic withdrawal and their anxiety is at a 10 out of 10 every single day, they're not able to participate in their therapy. Just like we would treat depression or anxiety by stabilizing them with medication at times, we are stabilizing the substance use effect and to where they are able to do the work and then not have this preoccupation with using all of the time.
Yeah, then that makes a ton of sense. Are there, sort of that being the case, are there any modifications then, once you kind of get somebody stabilized and you feel like they're ready to begin a specific treatment, are there any continued modifications you use, or is after that point, is it sort of more standard practice of some of those EBPs?
So in my particular field, because we're in an inpatient setting, we have a lot of safety net to where we can kind of push a little bit more. I would say in an outpatient setting where they're going home, there may be a little bit more time that needs to be developed there. But typically when they're coming in my office, I'm like, let's hit it because we don't have a lot of time. I want to get as much done as we possibly can, but also knowing to go at their pace. There could be this really rough stabilization process, or it could be very seamless and you would never know the difference. So it just is a very case-by-case situation. I think if the client is coming in and they're like, I am so groggy today, we're not going to go into EMDR that day or go into working on some really heavy stuff. We're just going to hold space and go through talk therapy at that point, whatever is the best person-centered approach at that point.
That makes a lot of sense to me. And it especially makes sense that you would start this type of treatment in an inpatient setting if you're able to have all those safety nets, because it certainly seems like it could be scary or tenuous and is starting in kind of an outpatient setting. It made me wonder though, how often you're able to complete treatment in that inpatient setting. Like, do you have enough time to do it, or do patients often end up transitioning kind of mid-treatment into a less restrictive treatment setting? What is there a trajectory, or does that really vary widely?
So I think, and you're referring to mat treatment specifically.
I guess MAT treatment, thank you for clarifying, MAT treatment, and then in conjunction to with an evidence-based treatment like EMDR, for example.
Sure. So EMDR without MAT treatment, I think an inpatient is just really difficult to get a lot done, but we can start. I've had really great success with some where we get multiple targets done, and then others we don't even get to a target. So again, it's case by case. And I always want to refer them to continue after here, and they'll go to a lower level of care and hopefully have another therapist who can continue what we've been working on. MAT treatment, I think on its own typically is a long-term treatment. We've seen that there's evidence that shows a year or more is a higher rate for success for people to stay sober if they're on MAT treatment. I used to work in an outpatient MAT treatment where methadone is provided. That's a very old school version of MAT. There's a lot of controversy around it, but it did save people's lives. That outpatient setting was very different than my experience in an inpatient setting. And so the therapy looks even a little different there because it's you get it once a month. You are not really getting to go like hard into stuff unless that client is willing to do that in that time. But using evidence-based practice such as EMDR or prolonged exposure or CPT is not going to happen in those settings. So the requirements per the powers that be who make them is that they see a clinician once a month. So the evidence-based practice part is a little bit absent. But if you have a client who's on MAT treatment and you're seeing them regularly, I think that it is super appropriate to continue doing both.
And just so it sounds like MAT treatment is at least a year, or like it, you have the best benefit if you're able to continue that for a year. There's the stabilization period up front, but then once they get stabilized, then it's a good time to begin the EBP and kind of get some of that work done. They're still getting the MAT treatment. You probably finish your EBP work, and then the MAT treatment kind of continues for that follow-on period. What happens then? Like, you know, how do you determine when MAT treatment is done? I mean, I know when we would return, we can determine when an EBP has had its
Sure.
benefit, like our clients' PCL scores have come down, their functional gains, like there's all the stuff going on that we see them take back in their territory or taking back parts of their territory. So then, you know, like there's this, how long does it continue that they stay on the mats? Sounds like about a year. And then what happens when they come off? Is there any kind of increase in some of those, like, and we keep talking about PTSD, so we'll continue down that trajectory. Like, do we see, any kind of increase in symptoms at that time, or, you know, what does it look like longer term, and sort of any return to substance use? Those, like, what does that picture look like?
Sure. So I think it's a case by case situation. Each person can kind of determines when they're ready to get off. There are people who will stay on it their entire life because it's maintaining their life for them where their life was unmanageable prior to. Now, there are some people who do it shorter than a year, and we do recommend longer for at least for a little while because in addiction, the brain's still healing itself. So there's a theory that it takes 2 years for the brain to repair itself after stopping using substances. And while this medication is kind of playing into those same brain receptors, it is still a maintenance versus an abuse mindset. So I think it's a case-by-case situation on how long a client will stay in MAT treatment. And it depends on how much work they did outside of just taking a medication. If they did the work with the evidence-based treatment and they were able to get some benefit out of that, then I think there's probably a higher rate of them being successful getting off because they're addressing those underlying issues that led to the addiction. Now, I don't
Right.
know. I don't know the research behind what the probability of PTSD rising after. I don't have that information, especially because I work in this particular setting. We don't get to see
Sure.
the long-term
Long
effect,
term, yeah.
unfortunately.
I think that you have kind of reaffirmed for me, Catherine, that this is really complicated to address when a patient has these comorbid issues and they need that medication-assisted treatment. And importantly, at the same time, it is life-saving. Like you said before, it's challenging and complicated, but it's life-saving. And I'm so glad that you offer a way for people to get that treatment, that necessary life-saving treatment. So I'm so glad you're doing that. And I'm glad you're here to educate us. This might be a nice transition point to talk about what we call actionable intel for our listeners, mm-hmm. which is for our listeners who may be in a boat similar to myself or Jenna, where we're just learning about this for the first time. Are there particular resources that you could offer to our listeners who want to learn more, want to get training, want to become more familiar? Any directions that you could point them in or guidance that you could offer?
Yes. So I think that SAMHSA is a really great resource, and they're like the addiction hub. So they have information about MAT treatment, lots of research that's there. If you look up SAMHSA's website, they are a wealth of knowledge to get more information. I think that's probably one of the best resources I can give to people. You can Google MAT treatment all you want, and I'm sure you're going to have a lot of different views on it too, because like I said before, it is very polarizing. There are a lot of people who believe it's a crutch for people, or they're replacing one drug for another. But as we stated before, it saves people's lives. It helps people be able to recover. And so I think being able to get more information and more education is really important. That would be my main location to go, because you're going to get reliable and unbiased information from that source. Every major metropolitan city, I would think, has a pretty decent amount of MAT providers. That's also a challenge, how to get into a MAT treatment. There's a way to just kind of Google that, and then you have to kind of call around. It's some places take insurance, some people don't. There's a lot of just variation in what you're looking for sometimes when getting into MAT treatment. Like I said before, the alcohol MAT treatment is a lot easier to get because a primary care physician may be able to prescribe that for you. So if somebody is struggling with alcohol use and they're like, man, I'm really struggling with these cravings, talk to your primary care provider. Maybe they can help you out with an anti-craving medication, which we would consider medicated assisted treatment. So those are kind of some resources I would provide. Like I said, SAMHSA is probably your best place because it's going to be research unbiased information. And I believe they do have ways of helping you find providers in your area.
That's awesome. One thing that we always end up talking about on this podcast is the importance of being able to collaborate or consult with peers. And I don't want to put words in your mouth, although I do with every guest, but particularly since you're talking about how challenging this is and how all of the polarizing views, have you found that that's helpful when it comes to MAT treatment as well, to be able to utilize consultation or have a network of providers that you consult with?
Yes, I think it's really useful to have a collaborative outlook. It's not just a medical provider, it's a clinician involved in it. It's very multidisciplinary. So being able to have cohesive teams that work in MAT treatment is really beautiful. That's something I love about working here, is we work very closely with our medical team to be able to provide the best quality care for these clients, and be able to educate the clients as a clinician, not only from a medical side, but from a clinical side as well. And just being collaborative and cohesive is really important. And I think it helps clients feel safer in their decision. And like, okay, I'm hearing this from multiple sources, so there is something to this that might be to my benefit.
Yeah, it seems to me like trying to do this work independently would be really hard, and having a treatment team seems maybe very obvious to say, but seems really important.
Very, very. Yeah.
Well, Jenna, did you have any other ideas that came up to you?
I just was wondering, one other sort of actionable intel. I think what we've got so far is great, and I know we'll summarize that shortly, but you know, for those providers out there who are listening, any advice on like good to ask questions with their clients that maybe that aren't in their repertoire, they don't tend to ask, that might open the door to finding out some good information from clients who do meet that dual diagnosis, you know, kind of category questions. Sometimes I feel like if we're assessing, you know, we're down that PTSD route, we try to do a thorough assessment of all the other things, but like what might be helpful that they could take to their practice tomorrow as a good to ask, you know, question or set of questions that you think have been helpful in the work you've done?
Sure. Ooh, that's a good one. I think asking your clients, one, knowing if their life is kind of unmanageable for them at this point. How is life working for you with managing your substance use, trying to stop your substance use? Maybe asking clients kind of where their readiness is, assessing their readiness, I think would be really good. If they're ready and they're just hitting brick wall after brick wall and they're trying and they're noticing how defeated that they're getting, and it just feels like an unmanageable task for them to stop, then maybe that's time to provide this information about, hey, have you thought about this option of getting some extra help? And maybe I can help you find a resource in doing that. I know this is very like, oh, I don't want to touch Matt because I'm not a medical provider, but we, like talking about earlier, having a collaborative team effort, I think is really important. So yeah, for providers to know some of your local Matt providers as well, and then being able to know kind of what their requirements are would be really good. And then helping clients be educated on their options, because a lot of them just don't know, or there's the stigma of, absolutely, well, I don't want to do that because what's the difference?
Absolutely. I think, and that's such a great answer. Because I think to your point, we sometimes are like, ooh, that's not my wheelhouse or that's not my lane, but the psychoeducation is your lane, right? Helping your client to be an informed consumer is definitely your lane. So you have to kind of educate yourself to be able to lead them there.
Absolutely.
Those are great points for our actionable intel items. So we're going to summarize all of those. We're going to provide in our show notes, as we always do, links for the information that we discussed today. So we'll include links for SAMHSA. We'll include links to the Ripple Ranch recovery site. And actually at CDP, we also have a number of resources on motivational interviewing on our website. And so I'm glad that when I thought of that when you were mentioning assessing readiness to change. So we'll also include a link for those in our show notes as well, so that listeners can access all of this great information. I, for one, am really grateful to have had you join us, Catherine, for giving us that introduction to Matt. And while confirming for me that it still feels a little bit intimidating, at least recognizing that there's a way in and that it is worth the effort, because it really does save lives.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Thank you for letting me get to share about it.
That was great. And thanks everybody out there for joining us. And we hope you tune in next time. Have a great day.
Bye, everyone.
Thanks for listening to Practical for Your Practice.
Please feel free to subscribe, like, and share.
Until next time.